I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are coming back to Atlanta right now. Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Listen to The Passage now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Let's do it.
Let's start the podcast.
Let's start the podcast.
All right. Well, let's have that be what starts the podcast, what we just said.
I liked it.
Let's start the podcast. Let's start the podcast. Well, I'm Robert Evans.
Yep. I'm Sophie Lichterman.
I never introduced myself.
I'm Jamie.
Who are you?
I'm
Jamie Loftus.
Yes.
Anything more we need to say? Are we done with the episode?
Anderson's here.
No, I think that, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anderson is here.
Sure. Well, you know what's happening in the world?
No.
Facebook is happening to the world, and it's bad.
That's unfortunate.
It's not great, Jamie. It's not great, Sophie. Not a fan of the Facebook. We left off having gone through some of the Facebook papers, particularly employees attacking their bosses after Jan 6th, when it became clear that the company they were working for was completely morally indefensible.
I wouldn't call it attacking.
They already knew.
I wouldn't call it attacking either. I would call it,
there's a guy, like the quote there, there was the guy who was like, history won't judge us kindly. When we didn't ban Trump in 2015, that's what caused the Capitol riot.
I mean, facts are facts. Is that really attacking if you're just like,
Well, I think, I think stating facts can be an attack.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay. Put it on a t-shirt.
Yeah. I mean, for people like this, you know, I think stating facts can be an attack. And we ended part one by sharing some of the blistering criticisms of Facebook employees against, you know, management and the service itself. So as we start part two, it's only proper that we cover how Facebook responded to all of this internal criticism. As I stated last episode, Facebook is in the midst of a years-long drought of capable engineers and other technical employees. They are having a lot of trouble hiring all of the people that they need for all of the things they're trying to do. So one of the things is, for a lot of these employees, when they say things that are deeply critical, they can't just dismiss the concerns of their employees outright, because if they were to do that, these people would get angry and they need them, right? Facebook's not in the strongest position. When it comes to the people who are good engineers, they have to walk a little bit of a tightrope. However, if they were to actually do anything about the actual meat of the concerns, it would reduce profitability and in some cases destroy Facebook as it currently exists. So they're not going to do anything, which has meant that they've had to get kind of creative with how they respond. So Mark and his fellow bosses pivoted and argued that the damning critique...
We're calling him Mark now.
Yeah, old zucky zuck. So when this all comes out and people are like, boy, it sure seems like all of your employees know that they're working for the fucking Death Star. Zuckerberg and his like mouthpieces made a statement that like all of these damning critiques from people inside the company were actually evidence of the very open culture inside Facebook, which encouraged workers to share their opinions with management. That's exactly what a company spokesperson told The Atlantic when they asked about comments like history will not judge us kindly. The fact that they're saying we'll be damned by historians means that we really have a healthy office culture.
Hashtag Death Star proud.
Yeah.
Death Star proud, everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the fact
that remove the stigma of working for the devil, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, come on.
The devil, I would be proud to work for because he's done some cool stuff. Like, have you ever been to Vegas? Nice town.
Oh, I've been to Vegas. Mm-hmm. I saw the Backstreet Boys in Vegas before two of them were revealed to be in QAnon. So really caught the end of that locomotive.
Oh, wow. I did not realize that a sizable percentage of the Backstreet Boys had gotten into QAnon. That makes total sense. 40%
of the Backstreet Boys, they're from Florida. They're ultimately five men from Florida. So what can you do?
As the author of that article, the Atlantic article, noted, this stance allows Facebook to claim transparency while ignoring the substance of the complaint. And the implication of the complaints that many of Facebook's employees believe their company operates without a moral compass. All over America, people used Facebook to organize convoys to DC and to fill the buses they rented for their trips. And this was indeed done in groups like the Lebanon Main Truth Seekers, where Kyle Fitzsimmons posted the following, quote, "This election was stolen and we are being slow walked towards Chinese ownership by an establishment that is treasonous and all too willing to gaslight the public into believing the theft was somehow the will of the people. Would there be an interest locally in organizing a caravan to Washington, D.C. for the Electoral College vote count on January 6th, 2021? And Kyle recently pled not guilty to 8 federal charges, including assault on a police officer. Mark Zuckerberg would argue that, like, Facebook didn't play a significant role in organizing January 6th and couldn't have played a significant role in radicalizing this guy and many other people. But the reality is that for the people, like, the people who managed part of what led Kyle Fitzsimmons to go assault people on January 6th was the fact that he had been radicalized by a social network that for years made the conscious choice to amplify angry content and encourage anger because it kept people on the site more, right? Like all of the anger that boiled up at January 6th that came from a number of places, but one of those places was social media because social media profited and specifically Facebook knowingly profited from making people angry. That was the business. And of course, it blew up in the real world.
I have a question just out of your own experience and observation, which is how do you like if you're doing a side by side case study of how Facebook responded to events like this versus how like YouTube/Google responded to radicalization? Are there like significant differences? Did anyone do better?
Yeah.
Or differently?
Yes. Twitter has done better than probably most of them. YouTube, I mean, and again, I'm not saying to say that Twitter's done well or that YouTube has done well.
Sure.
But they've both done, particularly with coronavirus disinformation, a bit better than Facebook. And they were better in general on not really YouTube as much, but like Twitter was definitely has been the most responsible of the social networks around this stuff.
It did seem like for a while there, the various networks were kind of like duking it out to see who could do the absolute worst and damage the most lives. And it seems like Facebook won that.
I would say Facebook.
But
and again, Twitter chose to do a lot of the same toxic things Facebook did. So did YouTube. And they did it all for profit. A number of the things we've criticized Facebook for, you can critique YouTube and Twitter for. I would argue Twitter certainly has done more and more effectively than Facebook. Not enough that they're not being irresponsible, because I would argue that Twitter has actually been extremely irresponsible and knowingly so. Mm-hmm. But I think Facebook, in my analysis, Facebook has been the worst, although I haven't studied as much about like TikTok yet. So we'll see. But my analysis.
Robert, you got to get on TikTok.
I hope
you pivot out of podcasting and into TikTok dances.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the dances that concern me on TikTok. It's the minute long conspiracy theory videos that have convinced a number of people that the Kardashians are Armenian witches and had something to do with the collapse of the Astro Worlds or the deaths in the Astro World thing.
My concern there is the dances that go over those conspiracy videos and really marry the worst of both worlds.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because
that's
I have
a thing.
Seen dancing on TikTok. There, I have seen conspiracy videos that involve dancing.
Incredible.
And skincare routine. Have you ever seen a conspiracy video where someone's also doing their skincare routine? Because that is a thriving
subgenre. Yeah, I'm sure that's. Yeah. So, well. I
have.
None of, all of,
just,
all of,
I was like, that is just a thing that does. Exists on many platforms.
I will say, I kind of, all
there's a YouTube channel
social
I watch that's
media
kind of,
companies yeah. are willfully bad at stopping radicalization mm-hmm. Because making people angry and frightened is good for all of their bottom lines. So they all knowingly participate in this. I think Facebook has been the least responsible about it, but that shouldn't be taken as praise of anybody. Like saying Twitter has done the best is saying like, well, we were all drunk driving, but John could actually walk most of a straight line before vomiting. So he was the least irresponsible Twitter, of us who drunk drove that night.
Just to put it in terms that I understand, it sounds like Twitter is the Backstreet Boy that's like, look, I don't believe in QAnon, but I see their points. That's kind of the vibe I'm getting.
Fair enough. So when deciding which posts should show up more often in the feeds of other users, Facebook's algorithm weighs a number of factors. The end goal is always the same, to get the most people to spend the most time interacting with the site. For years, this was done by calculating the different reactions a post got and weighing it based on what responses people had to it. And again, for years, the reaction that carried the most weight was anger, the little snarling smiley face icon you can click under a post. It was at one point being weighted 5 times more than just like a like.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Like, when I'm saying this was all intentional, they were like, people who respond angrily to posts, that keeps them on the site more. They spend the most time engaging with things that make them angry. So when it comes to determining how we choose to have the algorithm present people with posts, the posts that are making people mm-hmm. angriest is the posts our algorithm will send to the most people. That's a conscious choice. That's a conscious, yeah.
It's so funny how, I mean, not funny, it's mm-hmm. tragic and upsetting, yeah. but just how specific the Facebook audience is, that it's like you would have to be the kind of person who would be like, I'd better react angry to that. I better be as specific as possible in my feedback to this post, which is Farmville moms and
yeah, it's boomers.
People who have been pilled.
It's boomers. And and yeah, they just kind of knowingly set off a bomb in a lot of people's fucking brains.
They're addicted to telling on themselves for no reason.
Yeah.
Why? Now, why? Anyways.
Facebook has something called the Integrity Department. And these are the people with the unenviable task of trying to fight misinformation and radicalization on the platform. They noted in July
2020. That is so embarrassing. Imagine going on a first date.
Yeah.
Just going on a first date and be like, I work for the Facebook Integrity Department. Like, yeah good fucking luck.
Yeah, I work for the
Never
Air
have sex
Force.
Again in your life.
My job is to go door to door and apologize to people after we bomb them. We have gift baskets for the survivors. You know, like it's that's the gig, really.
I send edible arrangements to people who have been drone striked. Like, oh, Jesus. Awful.
And a lot
bad.
Of there's was one of the my favorite follows on Twitter is Brooke Binkowski, who used to work for Facebook mm-hmm. and was like one of the people early on who was trying to warn them about disinformation and radicalization on the platform years ago and left because like it was clear they didn't actually give a shit. And a lot of the Integrity Department people are actually like really good people who are a little bit optimistic and kind of young and come in and like, okay, it's my job to make this huge and important thing a lot safer. And these people get chewed up and spit out very, very quickly. And the members of the integrity team were kind of analyzing the impact of weighing angry content so much. And some of them noted in July 2020 that the extra weight given to the anger reaction was a huge problem. They recommended the company stop weighing it extra in order to stop the spread of harmful content. Their own tests showed that dialing the weight of anger back to zero, so it was no more influential than any other reaction, would stop rage-inducing content from being shared and spread nearly as widely. This led to a 5% reduction in hate speech, misinformation, bullying, and posts with violent threats. And when you consider how many billions of Facebook posts there are, that's a lot less nasty shit, some of which is going to translate into real-world violence. And again, this was kind of a limited study, so who knows how it would have actually affected things in the long run. So Facebook made this, well,
less money, question mark?
Yeah, this actually was kind of a win for them. Facebook did make this change. Oh, okay. They pushed it out in September of 2020. And the employees responsible deserve real credit. Again, there's people within Facebook who did things that really actually were good. Like changing this was probably like made the world a bit healthier. That said, the fact that it had been weighted this way for years, you don't undo that just by dialing it back now. For one thing, anger has become such an aspect of the culture of Facebook that even without weighing the anger emoji, most of the content that goes viral is still stuff that pisses people off, because that's just become what Facebook is, because that's what they selected for years. Like, it also, right. Like, who knows, like, if they'd done this years ago, if they'd never weighted anger more, it might be a very different platform with, like, a very different impact on the brains of, for example, our aunts and uncles.
I think that that's really interesting, too, because that timeline lines up pretty quickly with or pretty exactly with where it feels like a lot of younger people were leaving that platform and the mm-hmm. platforms became yep. associated with older people. Because I feel like I don't think I was using Facebook consistently after 2017, I want to say, was maybe my last Facebook year.
Yeah, I stopped. I mean, I stopped visiting it super regularly a while back. Yeah, maybe around 2017.
Right.
So in April of 2020, Facebook employees came up with another recommendation. And this one wouldn't be as successful as changing, you know, the reaction of the algorithm to the angry reaction. Spurred by the lockdown and the sudden surge of QAnon, Boogaloo, and anti-lockdown groups urging real-world violence, it was suggested by internal employees that the newsfeed algorithm deprioritize the posting of content based on the behavior of people's Facebook friends. So the basic idea is this. What Facebook was doing was, you would, if normally, like the way you'd think it would work, right, is that like your friends post something and you see that in your newsfeed, right? Like the posts of the people that you've chosen to follow and say are your friends, right? That's how you would want it to work. It's how it worked at one point. They made a change a few years back where they started sending you things, not because someone you followed had said something, but because they'd liked a thing. Or they'd commented, like not necessarily even commented, just like liked a thing. Like if they'd reacted to a thing, you
engaged
would get the thing.
Engaged in any way?
You would get that sent to your news feed. Members of the integrity team start to recognize like this has some problems in it. For one thing, it results in a lot of people getting exposed to dangerous bullshit. They start looking into like the impact of this and how just sharing the kind of things your friends are reacting to influences what you see and what that does to you on Facebook. The integrity team experimented with how changing this might work, and their early experiments found that fixing this would reduce the spread of violence-inciting content. For one thing, what they found is that like normally, if you hadn't seen someone like a post about something that was maybe like violent or aggressive or conspiratorial, like a flat earth post or a post urging the execution of an elected leader, if you hadn't seen anyone that you knew react to that post, even if you saw it, you wouldn't comment on it or share it. But they found that like if right. you just saw that a friend had liked it, you were more likely to share it, which increases exponentially the spread of this kind of violent content. And it's this idea like the whole people stopped being afraid to be racist at a certain point as much as they had been earlier. And it led to this surge in real world violence. It is kind of the same thing. People felt by seeing their friends react to this, they felt permission to react to it too in a way maybe they would have like, well, I don't want to like, maybe I'm interested in flat earth shit, but I'm just going to ignore this because like I don't want to seem like a kook.
That is so fucking upsetting and fascinating in the way that it affects your mind is there was a time where you would, if you were racist, misogynist, homophobic, whatever you were, but you just didn't talk about it. But then all of a sudden there's this confirmation that like, hey, this person you know and see all the time feels the same fucking way you do. So why be quiet about it?
Yeah.
Let's discuss. Like, it's just, that's so dark.
It's really dark. And so the integrity team sees this and they're like, we should change this. We shouldn't be showing people just like the reactions their friends have had to content because it seems to be bad for everybody. They do find in some of their, you know, because when they experiment, they're like, we'll take this country or this city and we'll roll this change out in this limited geographical location to like try and see how it might affect its scale. And they do this and they see that like, oh, changing this significantly reduces the spread of specifically violence inciting content. So they're like, hey, we should roll this out service-wide. Zuckerberg himself steps in, according to Francis Haugen, the whistleblower, and, quote, rejected this intervention that could have reduced the risk of violence in the 2020 election. From The Atlantic, quote, an internal message characterizing Zuckerberg's reasoning says he wanted to avoid new features that would get in the way of meaningful social interactions. But according to Facebook's definition, its employees say engagement is considered meaningful even if it entails bullying, hate speech, and reshares of harmful content. The episode, like Facebook's response to the incitement that proliferated between the election and January 6th, reveals a fundamental problem with the platform. Facebook's mega scale allows the company to influence the speech and thought patterns of billions of people. What the world is seeing now through the window provided by reams of internal documents is that Facebook catalogs and studies the harm it inflicts on people, and then it keeps harming people anyway.
See, that is so, that's always so interesting to hear. And by interesting, I mean, you know, psychologically harmful.
Yeah.
But because it's like, yes, that is a fundamental flaw of the platform, but that's also very entrenched into like what the DNA of the platform always was, which was based on harshly judging other people. Like that's why Mark Zuckerberg created Facebook, was to harshly judge women in his community. So it's like, I know that it is, you know, on a bajillion scale at this point, but I'm always kind of stunned at how people are like, oh, it's so weird that this went, you know, the way that it did. It's like, well, to an extent, it was always like that. And maybe it was like cosplaying as not being like that. And for certain people, there were eras in Facebook where your user experience wouldn't be like that. But it, you know, this goes back almost 20 years at this point of this being in the DNA of this this shit show.
Yeah. And it's really bleak. It's just really bleak. And it also goes to show like the one of the things Zuckerberg will say repeatedly when he talks about when he does admit like, yes, there are problems and there have been like negatives associated with the site. And we're aware of that. They're humbling. But like, you know, you also have to include all the good that we're doing, all of the meaning. And the way he always phrases this is like all of the meaningful social interactions that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And then you realize
interactions that have taken place on Facebook.
When he says that, he's including as these internal documents, he includes bullying and people like making death threats and like talking about their desire to murder people. Like that's a meaningful interaction.
Oh,
people
meaningful.
Getting angry
meaningful.
And trying to incite violence together is a meaningful social interaction, which
I guess
yes,
that hate is like, not meaningless, that it that has meaning.
Yeah,
but
Klan meetings,
you know,
were meaningful social interactions, you know. You got to give the KKK that. The Nuremberg rally was a meaningful interaction.
The last meaningful interaction I had on Twitter led to like a rebound. I was dating, coming to my grandma's funeral, blackout drunk. So I, you know, it's all just a sliding.
Oh man,
scale.
God, it's been too long since I've shown up at a funeral, just too drunk to stand.
It is still one of my favorite memories with my family to this day. They're like, who is this guy? And I'm like, I don't really know.
He's drunk as shit, though.
He came on the Megabus.
Hell yeah, he did.
Megabus.
Getting drunk from a camelback on a Megabus. Yeah. That would be when I used to do a lot of bus trips, like when I was traveling and stuff. That would be one of the tactics is you fill like a thermos or a camelback with like 40% cranberry juice, 60% liquor, and just get
I'm
ruined.
Not above that in any
no,
way.
No, it's awesome.
I'm not above getting fucked up on a Megabus, but you know, on your way to my grandma's funeral, that was a move.
Me and my friends got like wasted in San Francisco one day, just like going shopping in broad daylight with a camelback, where we would get a bottle of orange flavored Trader Joe's Patron tequila, and we would get a half dozen lime popsicles, and you just throw the popsicles in with the Patron in the camelback. And throughout the day, it melts, and you just have constant cold margarita. It's actually fucking amazing.
That fucking
we were
rocks.
Wrecked.
Wait, I wish I knew when I was 22.
Oh, yeah. I recommend it heavily. You will get trashed, and people don't notice. Dude, walking around with a fucking camelback in San Francisco, nobody gives a shit.
Oh, my God. You're basically camouflaged.
Yeah. You know who else is camouflaged?
Who?
The products and services that support this podcast, camouflaged to be more likable to you by being wrapped in a package of the three of us. That's how ads work, Jamie.
Oh, I thought you were saying that you were taking ads from the U.S. Army Recruitment Center again.
I mean, it's entirely possible. But at the moment, we're just camouflaging. I don't know, whoever comes on next, you'll feel more positively about because of our presence here.
Wow.
That's how ads work. It's good stuff. Robert Evans here. And as a kid, I loved playing Monopoly, but my favorite thing about it was robbing the bank, you know, working with my friends to pull over a con on somebody else, even heisting their money sometimes. And now Monopoly Go brings that fun to your phone. It's one of those games that can bring out the most devious version of ourselves. You can bankrupt your friends by pulling heists on their vaults and even use a wrecking ball to shut down their monuments. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with your friends to unlock prizes or try to top the leaderboards. And whether you're working with somebody or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is a huge blast. Go download it now for free on the App Store or Google Play.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, we're back. My goodness. What a good time we're all having today. How are you doing, Jamie?
You make it okay. Mm-hmm. You made it sound sarcastic. I am having a good time.
Well, I'm glad. I'm happy that you're having a good time. That's my only goal for this show and for you is a good time.
See, now you're doubling down on it and I'm getting insecure.
I'm doubling down and I'm also talking more and more like an NPR talking head as I get quieter by the bit.
Now I'm going to start having a panic attack. I've never heard you talk this.
I know. This is how I talk to my cats when I'm angry at them.
Robert, honestly... Mm-hmm. I feel like we do have that dynamic. I feel like I'm a cat that you get angry at sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you jump on my desk and knock over my Zevia. It's infuriating.
Well, it's just for attention.
I know.
It's just for attention.
But I've got to work to keep you in expensive cat food. I only feed my cats the nice wet food.
I would rather have your attention than really nice food, okay?
No, that's not what my cats say. So there's just a shitload to say about how Facebook negatively impacts the increasingly violent political discourse in the United States and how they helped make January 6th happen. But I think the way I'd like to illustrate the harm of Facebook next is a bit less political. It also occurs in a different Facebook product. I'm talking about Facebook, the company, generally when I refer to Facebook. But now we're going to talk about Instagram. In part one, I mentioned that young people felt that removing likes from Instagram temporarily corresponded with a decrease in social anxiety. The impact of Instagram specifically on the mental health of kids and teens can be incredibly significant. One of the other Facebook internal studies that was released as part of the Facebook papers was conducted by researchers on Instagram. The study, which again almost certainly would never have seen the light of day if a whistleblower hadn't released it, found that 32% of teen girls reported Instagram made them feel worse about their body. 22 million teenagers in the United States log on to Instagram on like a daily basis. So that's millions of teen girls feeling worse about their body because of Instagram.
I've never been less surprised at
learning a thing.
A revelation.
Well, good news. It gets worse.
Yeah, like no fucking kidding.
So
good.
These researchers released their findings internally in March of 2020, noting that comparisons on Instagram can change how young women view and describe themselves. Again, not surprising. So company researchers have been investigating the way that Instagram works, though, for quite a while, years, about 3 years that they've like been doing this seriously. And their previous findings all back up the same central issue. Photo sharing in particular is harmful to teen girls. One 2019 report concluded, we make body image issues worse for 1 in 3 teen girls. Its findings included this damning line. Teens blame Instagram for increases in anxiety and depression. This reaction was unprompted and consistent across all groups. So like, they almost always mention that this app specifically makes them feel worse about their body, and we don't have to prompt them at all. Like, this just comes up when they talk about Instagram.
I mean, that truly, it's so, Sophie, I don't know how you feel. I mean, I truly think that, like, because I've been on Instagram since, what, like, 2014, some shit like that.
No, earlier. I think like, we've been on earlier. It was around when we were in high school.
I truly think my life and my relationship to my body would be very different.
100% would be different.
Had not been on that app for the better part of a decade.
I mean, especially when they introduced filters.
Yeah, we're about to talk about that.
Yeah.
So,
here's
the kicker. And by kicker, I mean the bleakest part. In teens who reported suicidal thoughts, 13% of teens in the UK and 6% of teens in the United States claimed their desire to kill themselves started on Instagram.
That's fucking disgusting and terrible.
That's pretty bleak. More than 40%
again,
of Instagram.
Again, I just like, I wish I were more surprised. Like,
yeah, of course. I know.
But it's good to have this data. The data shows that more than 40% of Instagram users are less than 22 years old, which means you've got 22 million teens logging onto the service in the US every day. 6% of those people becoming suicidal as the result of Instagram is 1.32 million children who started wanting to kill themselves while using Instagram. Hey everybody, Robert Evans here, and I actually screwed up the math that I just cited, which is often the case when I do math. So anytime I do math of my own in an episode, you're right to question me. I was calculating 6% of 22 million, basically. But as the study noted, it's 6% of kids who are suicidal say that their suicidal feelings started on Instagram. So I wanted to recalculate that. About 72 to 76, kind of depending on the source, percent of American teens use Instagram. There are about 42 million teenagers in the United States. I calculated from that, and about 19% of high school students of like teenagers seriously considered attempting suicide. So if we're just counting serious attempts or people who seriously considered attempting suicide, that's 5,745,600 teens who seriously considered suicide. 6% of those, if 6% of those kids had their suicidal feelings start on Instagram, that's 344,736 children in the United States whose suicidal feelings started on Instagram. And I furthermore found that about 9% of kids who seriously attempt suicide or seriously consider suicide attempt it. So of that 344,736 American teens whose suicidal feelings started on Instagram, about 31,020 26 kids attempt suicide. So about 31,000 kids in the United States on an annual basis attempt suicide because of suicidal feelings that started on Instagram. So that is the more accurate look at the data. And I apologize, as always, for the error. But what's interesting is that these studies do document, like, Facebook has is as physically harmful at scale as, like, a wide variety of narcotics. Like, most narcotics probably are less harmful at scale physically than Instagram. I think weed certainly is. So,
oh my God, if every teenager was smoking weed instead of doom scrolling on Instagram, the world would just be so fucking different.
If they were, if like they the were whole, chain the... smoking cigars instead of being on Instagram, we might be better off.
It's so weird because I think about, like, how I don't know, whatever. Like, I'm in my late 20s, so I feel like I have, like, a little bit of memory of, like, what life was like before you were constantly being encouraged to compare yourself to every single person you've ever met in your life, regardless of whether you know who they are, how they are, whatever. And I just call me nostalgic, but I liked how I felt better.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it's so absurd how much I know about people I don't give a shit about and how bad it makes me feel to know about the curated lives of people that I don't give a shit about and how I let that actively affect my daily life. And it's just, it's just fucking miserable.
It is. It's horrible. Miserable. It's horrible.
That said, I like flirting on the application, so, you know, it's complicated. Sure.
Now, here's why, despite the documented harm that Instagram does, nothing's ever going to change. As I stated, 22 million U.S. teens use the gram daily. Only 5 million log on to Facebook. So Instagram is almost five times as popular among teenagers as Facebook, where kids are leaving in droves. So Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg's invention, is now definitively just the terrain of the olds. And Facebook knows it. Kids are never going to come back because that's not how it being a kid works. Like, you don't get them back. They're going to continue to do new shit. Eventually, they'll leave Instagram for something else, you know? That's just the way it fucking goes.
Unless the 30-year nostalgic cycle is like, Facebook is actually back now. It's actually cool. And
I just don't think it gave anybody a good experience enough to have that. It's not the fucking Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
No one's getting dopamine hits. That's a good point. It's not like Flaming Hot Cheetos.
Yeah, nobody's thinking fondly back to scrolling Facebook when they were seven. They're thinking back to, I don't know, SpongeBob SquarePants.
And as well they should.
But at the moment, Instagram is very popular with teens, and Facebook knows that if they're going to continue to grow and maintain their cultural dominance, they have to keep bringing in the teens. They have to keep Instagram as profitable and as addictive as it currently is. And that's why they bought Instagram in the first place. They only paid like $1 billion for it. It was an incredible investment. And they spend 50%
only
more time.
Only $1 billion lemonade in a day.
Yeah, that's cheap as hell for something as influential and huge as Instagram.
That is true.
Not real.
Yeah.
I wonder, do you know what it's worth now?
I would guess significantly more than $1 billion. But I don't entirely know how to value it. But Facebook's like $1 trillion company now.
That's really
right. Yeah, they're
gross.
Very
and
profitable.
And Facebook fucking sucks.
And it's but Facebook, that includes Instagram, you know?
Oh, okay. So the entire
And among, you know, teens are one of the most valuable demographics to have for advertisers. And Instagram is where teens go.
Do you want the number? Its estimated value is $102 billion. So,
that's a good investment.
Good investment if money was real.
So the fact that so much is at stake with Instagram, the fact that it's such a central part of the company having any kind of future, is part of why Mark and company have been so compelled to lie about it. None of this stuff that we've been talking about was released when Facebook researchers got it. Of course not. They wouldn't want anyone to know this shit. In March of 2021, Mark took to Congress, where he was criticized for his plans to create a new Instagram service for children under 13. He was asked if he'd studied how Instagram affects children. And he said, "I believe the answer is yes." So not yes, I think we've studied that. He told them then, "The research we've seen is that using social apps to connect with other people can have positive mental health benefits." And I'm sure there's something that he's gotten paid researchers to come up with that he can make that case off of. I'm sure in certain situations, it may even be true. There are ways you can use social media that are good to your mental. I've legitimately smiled or had my heart warmed by things that happen on social media. It doesn't not happen.
And I do think that there is a case for, like, I mean, and it's, I, you can't credit Mark Zuckerberg with it, but just, I mean, going back to fucking like live journal days of just like friendships that have deepened as a result of social media, that's definitely a thing, but the costs outweigh the benefits there by quite a bit.
Yeah. It's great. So, so Mark goes on to say, you know, I think we've got research that shows it can have positive mental health effects. You know, I think we've studied whether or not how it affects children. But he doesn't talk about, he leaves out all the stuff that I, all the statistics, like about all the kids whose suicidal ideation starts on Instagram. They had that data when he went before Congress. He just didn't mention it. They hadn't told anyone that shit up. Like, he didn't say a goddamn word about it. Yeah. He was like, yeah, I think we've looked into it. And, you know, there's some ways in which it can be healthy. Not, and also 1.3 million American kids became suicidal because of our app. Like, he did not throw that info out.
Like, did he throw that? I mean, truly, I'm like up in the air of like, did he not say that because he didn't want people to know? Or did he just say that because he heard it and he didn't care and he forgot? Like, you just don't know with that guy. That is so fucking evil. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty great. And we'll talk more about that later. In May of 2021, okay, Instagram boss Adam Mosseri told reporters that he thought any impact on teen well-being by Instagram was likely, quote, quite small based on the internal research he'd seen. Again, they haven't released this research. He's saying, oh, we have research and it says that any kind of impact on well-being is pretty small. And again, the actual research by this point showed 13% of kids in the UK and 6% of kids in the United States were moved to thoughts of suicide by Instagram, which I would not call small. I wouldn't necessarily say it's huge, but that is not a small impact.
No, that is like thousands and thousands and thousands and possibly millions of children.
Yeah, that's significant. The Wall Street Journal caught up with Mosseri after the Facebook papers leaked. So they were able to like drill him on this a bit. And he said a bit more. Quote, in no way do I mean to diminish these issues. Some of the issues mentioned in this story aren't necessarily widespread, but their impact on people may be huge, which is like, again, a perfect non-statement.
That's right. They're like, but what about the thing we couldn't possibly gauge at all versus the thing that we did and we're actively distancing ourselves from? I mean, those statistics, that's like at least one kid in every classroom. Like, that is gigantic.
And when you read the responses of guys like Mosseri and compare them to the responses of guys like people like Mark Zuckerberg and official corporate spokespeople, it's very clear that they're working from the same playbook, that they're very disciplined in their responses. Because Mosseri does tell the Journal that he thinks Facebook was late to realizing there were drawbacks in connecting people in such large numbers. But then he says, I've been pushing very hard for us to embrace our responsibilities more broadly, which again says nothing. He then pivots from that to stating that he's actually really proud out of the research they've done in the mental health effects on teens, which again, they didn't share with anybody. And I would argue lied about by omission in front of Congress. He's proud of this because he says it shows Facebook employees are asking tough questions about the platform. Quote, for me, this isn't dirty laundry. I'm actually very proud of this research, which is the same thing Zuckerberg said about his own employees damning the service after Jan 6. It's
right. I was going to say that's the same exact thing as the like actually bad work, you know, talking about how the working for the Death Star is bad. Is like evidence of, oh, the Death Star is actually has a really open work culture. Like, no, I don't know. I feel like there are not many CEOs that are good at flipping a narrative, but Mark Zuckerberg is particularly bad at it.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, part of why they can be bad at it is it doesn't really matter. Or at least it hasn't fucking so far.
Sure.
But the patterns,
I mean, not enough to get a better figurehead.
No.
Like,
the pattern's pretty clear here. When a scandal comes out, deny it until the information that can't be denied leaks out, and then claim that whatever is happening at the site, whatever like our information you had about how harmful it is a positive, because it means that you were trying to do stuff about it, even if you actually rejected taking action based on the data you had and refused to share it with anybody else. Mosseri and Zuckerberg were also careful to reiterate that any harms from Instagram had to be weighed against its benefits, which I haven't found a ton of documentation on. In fact, as the Wall Street Journal writes, in 5 presentations over 18 months to this spring, the researchers, Facebook researchers, conducted what they called a teen mental health deep dive and follow-up studies. They came to the conclusion that some of the problems problems were specific to Instagram and not social media more broadly. This is especially true concerning so-called social comparison, which is when people assess their own value in relation to the attractiveness, wealth, and success of others. Social comparison is worse on Instagram, states Facebook's deep dive into teen girl body image issues in 2020, noting that TikTok, a short video app, is grounded in performance, while users on Snapchat, a rival photo and video sharing app, are sheltered by jokey features that keep the focus on the face. In contrast, Instagram focuses more heavily on the body and lifestyle. March 2020 internal research states it warns that the Explore page, which serves users photos and videos curated by an algorithm, can send users deep into content that can be harmful. Aspects of Instagram exacerbate each other to create a perfect storm, the research states.
Yeah, I mean, again, not a shocking revelation.
Yeah.
Over here, there, it is. I mean, I do think that lets TikTok and Snapchat get off a little easy there. Like, there is absolutely a toxic body image culture on there. And I feel like Thinspo will thrive on any platform it fucking gloms itself onto. But Instagram is particularly bad because it's like where so many lifestyle people have launched. And there's so many headless women on Instagram. It is shocking. There's so many, not like you macheted my head off, but like you're not encouraged to show your head by the algorithm, which sounds weird, but it is true. The less, like, it is just very focused on how you physically look. And then there's also this tendency to like tear people apart if they have edited their body to look a certain way, when it's like, well, that the algorithm rewards editing your body to look a certain way and to do all this.
And it's, you do bring up a good point,
Robert,
where it's like,
keep going.
It's frustrating that it's important to critique Facebook in relation to its competitors like TikTok and Snapchat. That can lead to the uncomfortable situation of like seeming to praise them when they haven't done a good job. They just haven't been as irresponsible. It's kind of like attacking like Chevron. If you look at all of the overall harms, including like their impact and like covering up climate change, maybe the worst of the big oil and gas companies. I don't know. It's debatable. But it's like if you're criticizing Chevron specifically, it doesn't. You're not saying BP is great. You're just being like, well, these are the guys specifically that did this bad thing, and they were the leaders in this specific terrible thing. Other bad things are going on, but we can't. Like, the episode can't be about how bad everyone. We're talking about Facebook right now. We have these documents from inside Facebook. I'm sure versions of this are happening everywhere else.
Listeners, in your everyday life, just don't use Facebook as a yardstick for morality.
You know what,
because
Jamie?
Because then you'll just end up letting a lot of people off for a lot of fucked up stuff.
I would say in your regular life, don't use Facebook is all the sentence we needed there.
Wow.
You were talking earlier about like, because Mark went up in front of Congress and was like, yeah, I think we've got research on this. And I've definitely seen research that says it's good for kids. We know everything I just stated, that quote I just read, everything like that's in those internal studies. We know that Mark saw this. We know that it was viewed by top Facebook leaders because it was mentioned in a 2020 presentation that was given to Mark Zuckerberg himself. We know that when in August of 2021, Senators Richard Blumenthal and Marsha Blackburn sent a letter to Mark Zuckerberg asking him to release his internal research on how his platform's impact child mental health. We know that he sent back a 6-page letter that included none of the studies we've just mentioned. Instead, the study said that it was hard to conduct research on Instagram and that there was no consensus about how much screen time is too much. Meanwhile, their own data showed that 40% of Instagram users who reported feeling unattractive said that the feeling began while they were on Instagram. Facebook's own internal reports showed that their users reported wanting to spend less time on Instagram, but couldn't make themselves. And here's a quote that makes it sound like heroin. Teens told us they don't like the amount of time they spend on the app, but feel like they have to be present. They often feel addicted and know that what they're seeing is bad for their mental health, but feel unable to stop themselves. That's Facebook writing about Instagram. Like, that's their own people saying this. Like, this is not some activist getting in here, you know?
I guess good on them, regardless of the level of self-awareness going on there. What I was thinking about earlier when it comes to anytime Zuckerberg is in front of Congress or in front of political officials, I feel like for a lot of people, the takeaway and the thing that gets trending is how little political officials and members of Congress understand about how the internet works. And that's the funny story is like, oh, Mark Zuckerberg talked about an algorithm and this comes up all the time. It comes up on Veep. It came up on Succession, of just like how not internet literate the majority of people who decide how the internet works are. And it's like, it almost becomes like a hee hee ha ha, old guy doesn't know how algorithm works. But it's like, well, the consequence of that is that it ends up making Mark Zuckerberg look way cooler than he is. And it also doesn't address the problem at all of like, no, Mark Zuckerberg is omitting something gigantic here, and the majority of our, you know, lawmakers in Congress don't have the fucking, you know, cultural vocabulary to even understand that. And that is like, and I guess it like makes for a couple of good memes, but it's just like this is bad.
Jamie, can you commit to cancel Finsta? Do you remember that horror? That was sad.
Oh, God.
That made me sad.
Right. Cancel Fizz. I mean, I think that was the most recent one where it's like, okay, yeah, that is, you know, objectively funny. But like the consequence of that is, I mean, that's ultimately a win for Instagram. And that's a win for Facebook, because it makes them look like they're operating on a level that the fucking government doesn't understand. And meanwhile, you know, one kid in every classroom is suicidal as a result of the inability of lawmaking officials to understand the effect that this has.
Yes.
It's just, it makes me real mad, Robert.
And one of the nightmarish things about this is that while these lawmakers don't understand and sound like idiots talking to Mark Zuckerberg, his own employees, these researchers who are part of the integrity team, these researchers studying the impact of Instagram on teens, know exactly how harmful it is. And they are grappling in real time with like the damage their product is doing to children. Members of these teams reported frustration at the fact that their colleagues often refuse to take their findings seriously. One former researcher told the Wall Street Journal that we're standing directly between people and their bonuses when they try to reduce the harm aspects of Instagram, because like anything that reduces the harm is going to reduce its popularity. It's going to cut down on time on site. It's going to cut down on users. And so everyone else at Facebook but the integrity team gets paid by how much they increase engagement on the site. That's where the bonuses come from. So if you're trying to make Facebook less dangerous, a huge number of the most influential employees have a vested financial interest in you failing. So that's
good. And what that boils down to is like, there is a financial incentive for you convincing a 13-year-old girl that she should get fucking fillers in her face. Like, what the fuck? It's just,
I'm going to try to sell the teens, because it's ad break time, Jamie, and I would like to.
Okay.
If you're a teenager.
Yeah.
You don't need Instagram. That shit's bad for you. You certainly don't need Facebook. That's where the olds are. But you know what's come back around to being cool, and what I think your generation needs to get on board with? Smoking huge comical cigars. I'm talking the ones that are like 9 inches long and like 3 inches wide. No. Massive. Teens listening right now, go out to your local cigar shop.
Do not
bribe a sad
Robert.
Adult. The worst looking
Robert.
Adult you find outside the cigar shop. Pay him for huge, cheap cigars.
I don't want people to talk to me.
And chain smoke them. That's the new Instagram, is chain smoking horrible cigars. This is what's going to bring.
I'm not buying teenagers.
Look, Zoomers.
I did. Wait.
Zoomers. The air's not getting any cleaner, right? We're all gonna choke to death on wildfire smoke. You might as well burn down a big fat Macanudo.
Robert, can I tell you? I bought a teenager a White Claw the other day.
I'm so proud of you.
Good for you.
Thank you. I felt good. I felt like I did a public service.
Yeah, teens, go buy those big, fat, ridiculous, lunatic cigars. Bribe a sad 40-year-old for it. You're just preparing yourself for climate change. All right, here's
the
other ads.
I'll buy you a White Claw, teens. Okay.
I mean, White Claw goes great with a huge, shitty cigar, Jamie.
No, it doesn't.
It absolutely does.
Smoking is bad for you.
Andy has a white paw.
You're not smoking a cigar. You puff it so it's healthy.
You puff.
All right, here's some ads. Robert Evans here, and as a kid, I loved playing Monopoly, but my favorite thing about it was robbing the bank, you know, working with my friends to pull over a con on somebody else, even heisting their money sometimes. And now Monopoly Go brings that fun to your phone. It's one of those games that can bring out the most devious version of ourselves. You can bankrupt your friends by pulling heists on their vaults and even use a wrecking ball to shut down their monuments. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with your friends to unlock prizes or try to top the leaderboards. And whether you're working with somebody or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is a huge blast. Go download it now for free on the App Store or Google Play.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage. A 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. We all just enjoyed a couple of really comically large cigars.
I
had one of those ridiculous long asylum cigars. It was great.
Why are you fixated on this? What is happening?
Because I find that sketch from I Think You Should Leave while the little girls are talking about smoking five Macanudos to unwind at the end of the day actually quite funny.
I mean, yeah, but like, why so are you?
I love when you reveal yourself to be a basic bitch.
I am a basic bitch.
I was watching Netflix. Netflix. That's why I'm thinking about cigars.
I love that. I love that we're in the middle of a podcast and you can't get off that.
Well, I also think making children do things that's bad for them is funny. But not this way. Not the way Facebook does it.
Send them to Dan Flashes. Send them to Dan Flashes.
I mean, they've already. I think the teens are rejecting NFTs pretty widely, Jamie. So when Facebook does try to make the case that their products are benign, they like to bring up studies from the Oxford Internet Institute, which is a project of Oxford University, which show minimal or no correlation between social media use and depression. The Wall Street Journal actually reached out to the Oxford researcher responsible for some of these studies, who right away wasn't like, oh, yes, they're right. Everything's fine. He was like, actually, Facebook needs to be much more open with the research that they're doing because they have better data than we can get, than researchers can get. And so our actual information that they're citing is hampered by the fact that they're not sharing what they're finding. And who knows how things could change and our conclusions could change if we had access to all of that data. He even told the Wall Street Journal, people talk about Instagram like it's a drug, but we can't study the active ingredient, which you'll notice is not him saying it's fine. It's him being like, yeah, I really wish we could actually study this better. It's difficult right now.
And also he's referring to it like drugs, which is the comparable scale of how it manifests. Cool.
He's certainly not being like, everything's fine. I think that's clear.
He's truly like constantly, Mr. Policeman, I gave you all the clues in this situation and just no one gives a shit.
It is very funny. And like that movie referencing.
And that's what I was trying to say is that it's hilarious. Yeah.
So we focused a lot on these episodes about how Facebook has harmed people and institutions in the United States. But as we've covered in past episodes, the social network has been responsible for helping to incite ethnic cleansings and mass racial violence in places like Myanmar and India. Mob violence against Muslims in India, incited by viral Facebook misinformation, led one researcher in February of 2019 to create yet another fake account to try and experience social media as a person in Kerala, India might. From the New York Times, quote, "For the next 3 weeks, the account operated by a simple rule. Follow all the recommendations generated by Facebook's algorithm to join groups, watch videos, and explore new pages on the site. The result was an inundation of hate speech, misinformation, and celebrations of violence, which were documented in an internal Facebook report published later that month." And this is from the Facebook researcher. "Following this test user's newsfeed, I've seen more images of dead people in the past 3 weeks than I've seen in my entire life total." What a great site Mark built. Facebook's new tagline, "The place for corpses."
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness. I mean, and it's like, I know that we have discussed Facebook's role in supercharging ethnic cleansings,
yeah.
But that is so ugh.
Yeah, it's not great, Jamie.
Someone wrote that down,
yeah.
Robert.
And
someone wrote that down and hit publish.
It's not greater because India is Facebook's biggest customer. 340 million Indians use one or more Facebook products. That's a shitload
currently?
Of people. Yeah. 340 million.
That is something that I think is important to remember, and something that I lose sight of sometimes is like Facebook is not a super popular platform for people of all ages in North America, but that's not the case everywhere.
Yeah, it is the internet for a lot of these people. That is the way that is the whole of how they consume the internet in a lot of cases. I mean, maybe with like YouTube mm-hmm. or something mixed in, but they're probably getting a lot of their YouTube links from their Facebook feed. The fact that India is the number one customer in terms of like number of people for Facebook, I'm sure the United States is still more profitable just because of like differences in income and whatnot. But this is a huge part of their business. But despite that fact, they have failed to invest very much in terms of meaningful resources into having employees who speak the language, or is this more the problem, the languages of India. See, India, super mixed country, right? In terms of different like ethnic groups and religious groups, they have 22 officially recognized languages in the country. And there's way more languages right. than that in India that significant numbers of people speak. There's 22 officially recognized languages. Anyone who can travel there, and I've spent a lot of time in India, can tell you that being able to effectively say hello and ask basic questions of people can require a lot of research if you're traveling a decent amount. But Facebook aren't 20 something tourists on the prowl for good tandoori and bong lassies. They have effectively taken control of the primary method of communication and information distribution for hundreds of millions of people, and they failed to hire folks who might know if some of those people are deliberately inciting genocide against other people in the country. 87% of Facebook's global budget for identifying misinformation is spent on the United States. The rest of the planet shares 13% of their misinformation budget. You want to guess what percentage of Facebook users North Americans make up? 10%. 87% of their budget goes on 10% of their users. Dealing with disinformation specifically. Now, when this leaked out, Facebook's response was that the information cited was incomplete and did not include third-party fact checkers. They're like, well, this doesn't include all of the people, the third-party companies we hire, except for the data they show suggests that the majority of the effort and money spent on third-party fact checkers is for fact-checking stuff in the United States. And of course, they did not elaborate on how including this information might have changed the overall numbers, so my guess is not by much of it all. Internal documents do show that Facebook attempted to create changes to their platform to stop the spread of the disinformation during the November election in Myanmar. Those changes, which also halted the spread of disinformation put out by the military, which was a big, like, it was the military inciting ethnic cleansings and, like, and trying to incite violence in order to, like, lock down political power ahead of this election. They cut this significantly prior to the election. They see it as a problem. They institute changes similar to the changes they'd talked about putting up in the U.S. if things went badly with the election, and these worked. It dropped dramatically.
That is good. I'm glad that was done, but it's only responded.
Give me a
the
second, Jamie.
Exclusively.
Give me a second,
okay.
Jamie.
Okay.
Because
okay.
prior to the election, they institute these changes, which are significant. It reduces the number of inflammatory posts by 25.1% and reduces the spread of photo posts containing disinformation by 48.5%. This is huge. That's really significant. Yeah. Yeah. As soon as the election was done, Facebook reversed those changes, presumably because they were bad for money.
No.
3 months after the election, the Myanmar military launched a vicious coup. Violence there continues to this moment. In response, Facebook created a special policy to stop people from praising violence in the country, one which presumably reduces the spread of content by freedom fighters resisting the military as much as it reduces content spread by the military. It's obviously too much to say that Facebook caused a coup in Myanmar. Shit's been, I mean, there's a lot going on there. I'm not pretending that this is like, it's all just Facebook. But
a major contributing factor.
It wasn't insignificant.
For sure.
And the fact that they knew how much their policies were helping and reversed them after the election, reversing this effect and leading to an increase in inflammatory content because it profited them more is damning, right? That's the thing that's damning. Yes. Around the world, Facebook's contribution to violence may be greatest in places where the company has huge reach but pays little attention. In Sri Lanka, people were able to automatically add hundreds of thousands of users to Facebook groups that spread violent content. In Ethiopia, a nationalist militia coordinated calls for violence openly on the app. The company claims that it has reduced the amount of hate speech people see globally by half this year. But even if that is true, how much hate was spread during the years where they ignored the rest of the world? How many killings? How many militant groups seeded with new recruits? How many pieces of exterminationist propaganda spread while Facebook just wasn't paying attention? The actual answer is likely incalculable. But here's the New York Times again, reporting on that test account in Kerala, India.
Perfect turn of phrase. Yeah.
10 days after the researcher opened the fake account to study misinformation, a suicide bombing in the disputed border region of Kashmir set off a round of violence and a spike in accusations, misinformation, and conspiracies between Indian and Pakistani nationals. After the attack, anti-Pakistan content began to circulate in the Facebook recommendation groups that the researcher had joined. Many of the groups, she noted, had tens of thousands of followers. A different report by Facebook, published in December 2019, found Indian Facebook users tended to join large groups, with the company's median group size at 140,000 members. In a separate report produced after the elections, Facebook found that over 40% of top views or impressions in the Indian state of West Bengal were fake or inauthentic. One inauthentic account had amassed more than 30 million impressions. A report in March 2021 showed that many of the problems cited during the 2019 elections persisted. In the internal document, called Adversarial Harmful Networks, India Case Study, a Facebook researcher wrote that there were groups and pages replete with inflammatory and misleading anti-Muslim content on Facebook. The report said that there were a number of dehumanizing posts comparing Muslims to pigs and dogs, and misinformation claimed that the Quran, the holy book of Islam, calls for men to rape their female family members. So that's significant. Like, the scale at which this shit spreads is huge.
I feel like I know the answer if the hate is existing on that scale unmitigated, but who is working to, like, how many people does Facebook have working on? Is there an integrity team for this region? Like,
technically, yes. The question is, okay, there, how many of them and how many of the languages there are represented by the team? And it's not many.
Exactly. Like,
it's not many.
You can't have a global company and not have global representation, or shit like this is going to happen. Like, it's just...
It's actually... You know what it kind of reminds me of, Jamie? I was looking at this and I was thinking about the East India Trading Company. When the East India Company took over large chunks of India... they took it over from a regime, the government, the monarchical government that had been in charge in that area prior was not a good government, right? Because number one, they lost that war, but like, they weren't a very good government. They were a government. So they did do things like provide aid in famines and disasters and have people whose job it was to like handle stuff like that and like handle, like make sure that like place the stuff was getting where it needed to go during like calamities and whatnot. And doing things specifically that helped people, but were not profitable, because a big chunk of what a government does isn't directly profitable. It's just helping to like keep people alive and keep the roads open and whatnot, right?
Yeah. Sustain humanity. Yeah.
When the East India Company took over, they were governing and in control of this region. And this is actually Bengal, I think, is their first place. But they don't have any responsibility. They don't have teams who are dedicated to making sure people aren't starving. They don't have people who are dedicated to actually keeping the roads open in any way that isn't necessary for directly the trade that profits them. They don't do those things because they're governing effectively, but they're not a government. And there's been a lot of talk about how Facebook is effectively like a nation, a digital nation of like 3 billion people, and Mark Zuckerberg has the power of a dictator. And one of the problems with that is that, for all of their faults, governments – have a responsibility to do things for people that are like necessary to stop them, like to deal with like calamities and whatnot. Facebook has no such responsibility. And so when people were not paying attention to Sri Lanka, to West Bengal, to Myanmar, they didn't do anything. And as we know, like 40 in a region where there are millions and millions of people, 40% of the views were fake, inauthentic content. You know, like because they don't give a shit what's spreading, because they don't have to, because they don't have to deal with the consequences unless it pisses people off, as opposed to a government where it's like, well, yeah, we are made up of the people who live here. And if things go badly enough, it can't not affect us. I'm not trying to be like with TikTok. I'm not trying to praise the concept of governance, but it is better than what Facebook's doing.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
It's. Yeah, I think that is like a very, I'd never considered looking at it that way, but viewing it as this kind of digital dictatorship that
a colonial dictatorship. It's colonized people's information, information streams. It's colonized the way people communicate, but it has no responsibility to them if they aren't white and wealthy.
Well, yeah, and marginalized people in the same ways that actual dictatorships do, in terms of how much attention is being given, how are people being hired to support and represent this area. And of course, the answer is no.
Yeah.
And of course, the result of that is extreme human consequence and harm. And it's so, and it like is just so striking to me that it still feels like, in terms of the laws that exist that control, I mean, that even attempt to address the amount of influence and control that a gigantic digital network like Facebook has, you know, that Facebook, I mean, unless people are yelling at them and unless their bottom line is threatened, they're never going to respond to stuff like this. Like that's been made clear for decades at this point.
Yeah, it's great. I love it.
Well, I'm all worked up.
Yeah. A great deal of the disinformation that goes throughout India on Facebook comes from the RSS, which is an Indian fascist organization closely tied to the BJP, which is the current ruling right-wing party. And when I say fascist, I mean like some of the founders of the RSS were actual like friends with Nazis, and they were heavily influenced by that shit in like the 30s. Both organizations are profoundly anti-Muslim, and the RSS's propaganda has been tied to numerous acts of violence. Facebook refuses to designate them a dangerous organization because of, quote, political sensitivities that might harm their ability to make money in India. Facebook is the best friend many far-right and fascist political parties have ever had. Take the Polish Confederation Party. They're your standard right-wing extremists, anti-immigrant, anti-lockdown, anti-vaccine, anti-LGBT. The head of their social media team, Tomasz Garbiczek, told the Washington Post that Facebook's hate algorithm, in his words, had been a huge boon to their digital efforts. Like, he calls it a hate algorithm and says, this is great for us, expanding that, like, I think we're good with emotional messages, and thus their shit spreads well on Facebook. Quote from the Washington Post. In one April 2019 document detailing a research trip to the European Union, a Facebook team reported feedback from European politicians that an algorithm change the previous year, billed by Facebook at chief executive Mark Zuckerberg as an effort to foster more meaningful interactions on the platform, had changed politics for the worst. This change, Mark claimed, was meant to make interactions more meaningful, but it was really just a tweak to the algorithm that made comments that provoked anger and argument even more viral. And I'm going to quote from the Post again here. In 2018, Facebook made a big change to that formula to promote meaningful social interactions. These changes were billed as a design to make the newsfeed more focused on posts from family and friends and less from brands, businesses, and the media. The process weighted the probability that a post would produce an interaction, such as a like, emoji, or comment, more heavily than other factors. But that appeared to backfire. Hogan, who this week took her campaign against her former employer to Europe, voiced a concern that Facebook's algorithm amplifies the extreme. Anger and hate is the easiest way to grow on Facebook, she told British lawmakers, many of whom have their jobs because of how easy it is to make people shit go viral when it causes anger.
Show me this, again, why it will never change. Or system of power that's not true for. Yeah.
Yes. We're focusing on Facebook here in part because I do think it's more severe in a lot of ways there, but also just because like they're the ones who had a big leak. And so we have this data. So we're not just saying, yeah, look at Facebook, obviously hate spreading. We're saying, no, we have numbers. We have their numbers about how fucking bad the problem is.
I guess that is the difference. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we have evidence that the system is well aware of the numbers.
Yeah, I would love to be talking about Twitter, too. It's just and maybe Twitter just never bothered to get those kind of numbers. Who knows? This caused what experts describe as a social civil war in Poland, like this change. One internal report concluded, we can choose to be idle and keep feeding users fast food, but that only works for so long. Many have already caught on to the fact that fast food is linked to obesity, and therefore, in its short-term value is not worth the long-term cost. So he's being like, we're poisoning people, and it's addictive, like, you know, McDonald's, but like people are going to give it up in the same way that McDonald's started to suffer a couple of years back, because like they don't like the way this makes them feel. Actually, like, it's fun for a moment, but it's horrible.
We just
got to
get a Morgan Spurlock for Facebook, baby. Yeah. We just got to get, where's the supersize me for Facebook?
Our entire society is the Morgan Spurlock for Facebook. January 6th was Morgan.
I was going to say, I was like, I feel like it's, whatever, not to say that McDonald's isn't a hell of a drug, but like this is not the same. I mean, I it's stronger because it's your fucking brain and self-image and the view of yourself. And I feel like that is the most strong manipulation that any given system, person, whatever can have on you, is controlling the way that you see yourself. It's not the same in terms of like involuntary baseness. I feel like it's something that you very much participate in. It's bad.
It's good. I think it's good. That's what I think, Jamie.
Oh,
Facebook has been aggressive.
Is that why you called me today to say good, actually,
to read all this and then say, so that's fine, let's never talk of it again. Anyway, Facebook has been aggressive at rebutting the allegations that their product leads to polarization. Their spokeswoman brought up a study which she said shows that academic research doesn't support the idea that Facebook, or social media more generally, is the primary cause of polarization. Now, ignore for the moment that not the primary cause doesn't mean isn't a significant cause. And let's look at this study. The spokeswoman was referencing cross-country trends in effective polarization, an August 2021 study from researchers at Stanford and Brown University. This study opens by noting it includes data for only 12 countries, and that all but Britain and Germany exhibited a positive trend towards more polarization. So, right off the bat, there's some things to question about this study, which is, number one, they're saying that, like, oh, Britain hasn't gotten more polarized, which is like, have you been there? Have you talked to it? But
don't live there, but not what I've been hearing from my friends that do.
Here's the thing. When you look at how Facebook is basically using this, citing this as like evidence that like, look, we're fine. Social media is not, this study from this very credible study says that we're not the cause of polarization. So everything's good. The study doesn't quite back them up on this. Right off the bat, one of the authors provides like notes this, and this is from a write-up by one of the authors on the study on a website called techpolicy.com, where he's talking about the study and what it says. A flat or declining trend over the 40 years of our sample does not rule out the possibility that countries have seen rising polarization in the most recent years. Britain, for example, shows a slight overall decline, but a clear increasing trend post-2000 and post-Brexit. So he's saying that, like, we don't have as much data from like more recent polarization, and that may be a reason why this study is less accurate and why some of our statements are not do not conform with like what people have observed. He goes on to note, the data do not provide much support for the hypothesis that digital technology is the central driver of effective polarization. The internet has diffused widely in all the countries we looked at, and under simple stories where this is the key driver, we would have expected polarization to have risen everywhere as well. In our data, neither diffusion of internet nor penetration of digital news are significantly correlated with increasing polarization. Similarly, we found little association with changes in inequality or trade. One explanatory factor that looks more promising is increasing racial diversity. The non-white share of the population has increased faster in the U.S. than in almost any other country in our sample. And other countries like New Zealand and Canada, where it has risen sharply, have seen rising polarization as well. So I have some significant arguments with him here, including the fact that, as he notes here, his study only looks at Western nations. With the exception of Japan, all of the nations in the study are European or the United States and Canada. And so they have all right. have had prior to 2000 higher penetrations of the internet and non-internet mass media. Like outside of this, if you're trying to determine the impact of social media, elements of what social media has done were present in places like Fox News in the United States years before Facebook ever existed. And that was not the case in places like Myanmar and India, which are not a part of this study. So right off the bat, it's problematic to try and study the impact of social media on polarization only in countries that already had robust mass media before social media came into the effect, which is not to say that I agree with their conclusion, because I think there's other flaws with this study. But one of the flaws is just that, like, hundreds of millions of their users exist in countries where they did not, the study was not done, where they were not looking right, at these places, which is a flaw.
Which is just like dependent on, and that's dependent on most readers just conflating, you know, North America and Europe with the center of the fucking world.
And, I have issues about, like, okay, well, you're saying that racial diversity is more of a thing, but like, where is the propaganda, where is the hate speech about racial diversity spreading? Is it spreading on social media? Like, yes, it is. I can say that as an expert. It's also just like, again, not that this study is even bad or not useful. It is one study. And again, we have internal Facebook studies that make claims that I would say throw some of this into question. But again, this is just how a corporation is going to react. They're going to find a study that they can simplify in such a way that they claim that they can claim there's not a problem, because nobody like none of the people who they're going to be arguing with on Capitol Hill and precious few of the journalists are going to actually drill into this and then talk to other experts or even reach out to members of that study and be like, how fair is this phrasing? How does it gel with this information? As we saw earlier with the last study, when the Wall Street Journal, to their credit, reached out to that scientist, he was like, well, actually, they have better data than me and I'd love to see it because maybe that'll change our conclusions. Anyway, Mark Zuckerberg has been consistent in his argument that deliberately pushing divisive and violent content would be bad for Facebook. Quote, we make money from ads, and advertisers consistently tell us they don't want their ads next to harmful or angry content. While I was writing this article, I browsed over to one of my test Facebook accounts. The third ad on my feed was for a device to illegally turn a Glock handgun into a fully automatic weapon. As a heads up. Yeah. I have a couple of test feeds, and it was like, hey, this button will turn your Glock automatic, which is so many felonies, Jamie. If you even have that thing in a Glock in your home, the FBI can put you away forever.
I have to laugh because that is really, really scary.
But yeah, it is like Mark being like, look, oh, no advertiser wants this to be a violent place. Buy a machine gun on Facebook, next to ads that are like t-shirts about killing liberals and stuff. Like
a machine gun advertiser. Or maybe would be one that wouldn't take issue with that. Holy shit.
I've had fucking hang the media shirts advertised to me on Facebook. Like, my God. Fuck you, Mark.
I used to, when I quit Facebook a couple of years ago, I was getting normie advertisements. I was getting
good for you.
Those really scary ones that says, like, those custom t-shirts that say, it's a Jamie Loftus thing.
Yeah.
You wouldn't understand.
I wouldn't. Like, why?
And you wouldn't.
Yeah, I would not. The only time Facebook I can think of recently actually anticipated something I wanted is they keep showing me on all of the accounts that I've used videos of hydraulic presses crushing things. And I do love those videos. Oh. Those are pretty fun.
And that's the meaningful social interactions that Mr. Mark Zuckerberg was talking about, was the hydraulic press videos. And those are very comforting.
On the good old internet, which also wasn't all that great, but on the old internet, which was it was a lot more fun, though. There would have just been a whole website that was just like, here's all the videos of hydraulic presses crushing things. Come watch this shit.
There wouldn't have been any algorithm necessary. You could just scroll through videos. There's no friend function. Mm-hmm. It's just hydraulic press shit.
Yeah, that's all I need, baby.
That's a fun version of the internet.
So back to the point, it is undeniable that any service on the scale of Facebook, again, like 3 billion users, is going to face some tough choices when it comes to the problem of regulating the speech of political movements and thinkers. As one employee wrote in an internal message, I am not comfortable making judgments about some parties being less good for society and less worthy of distribution based on where they fall in the ideological spectrum. That's true. This is, again, part of the problem of not regulating them like a media company, like a newspaper or something. Because by not making any choices, they're making an editorial choice, which is to allow this stuff to spread. Presumably, actually, like if you were actually being held to some kind of legal standard that, again, most of our media isn't anymore, you would at least have to be like, well, let's evaluate the truthfulness of some of these basic statements before pressing. And that, and I would say that's where the judgment right. should come in on. But that's expensive. If Facebook is saying we won't judge based on politics, but we will judge based on whether or not something is counterfactual, that I think is morally mm-hmm. defensible. But that's expensive as shit. And they're never going to do that.
Look, moral decisions are famously not cheap. And yeah. that is a lot of the reason why people do not do them.
Yeah. It is true
having
that having
morals is yeah. not a profitable venture.
Yeah, it's no, of course not. And the other thing that's true is that Facebook already makes a lot of decisions about which politicians and parties are worthy of speech. And they make that decision based mostly on whether or not said public figures get a lot of engagement. Midway through last right. year, they deleted and like all of the different anarchist media groups that had and a lot of anti-fascist groups that had accounts on Facebook just across the board. They deleted like Crime Think and they kicked off it's going down like a rapper. I know Soul. Like, yeah, they I mean, nobody ever complains when bad shit happens to anarchists except for anarchists. But yeah, they nuked sure. a bunch of anarchist content, just kind of blanket saying it was dangerous. And I think it was because they just nuked the Proud Boys and they had to be shown to be fair. But it has now come out that they have a whole program called X-Check or Cross-Check, which is where they decide which political figures get to spread violent and false content without getting banned. They
based
had
on engagement?
Yeah, based on engagement. They've claimed for years that everybody's sick. Accountable to site rules. But again, the Facebook papers has revealed that like that's explicitly a lie. And it's a lie Facebook has told other people at high levels of Facebook. And I'm going to quote from the Wall Street Journal here. The program, known as Cross-Check or X-Check, was initially intended as a quality control measure for actions taken against high-profile accounts, including celebrities, politicians, and journalists. Today, it shields millions of VIP users from the company's normal enforcement process, the documents show. Some users are whitelisted, rendered immune from enforcement actions, while others are allowed to post rule-violating material pending Facebook employee reviews that often never come. At times, the documents show, X-Check has protected public figures whose posts contain harassment or incitement to violence, violations that would typically lead to sanctions for regular users. In 2019, it allowed international soccer star Neymar to show nude photos of a woman who had accused him of rape to tens of millions of his fans before the content was removed by Facebook. Whitelisted accounts shared inflammatory claims that Facebook's fact-checkers deemed false, including that vaccines are deadly, that Hillary Clinton had covered up pedophile rings, and that then-President Donald Trump had called all refugees seeking asylum animals. According to the documents, a 2019 review of Facebook's whitelisting procedures marked attorney-client privileged found favoritism to those users to be both widespread and not publicly defensible. "We are not actually doing what we say we do publicly," said the confidential review. It called the company's actions a breach of trust and added, "Unlike the rest of our community, these people violate our standards without any consequence." And they lied to like their board members about whether or not this, they didn't lie about whether or not it was a thing. They said it was very small. And just for, I think the initial claim was like, we have to have something like this in place for people like President Trump, but it's a tiny number of people. And it's because they occupy some political position where we can't just as easily, you know, delete their account because it creates
you
other
can't
problems.
Write it off because they're not as fringe as they need to be for this conduct to be acceptable.
So that was their justification. Like, that is, one sec, Jamie. That was their justification.
That is like on the level of you can be unethical and still be legal. I
and
mean,
that's
it's
the way I live
still
my life.
True.
Uh-huh. Well, here's the thing. They told their board they only did this for a small number of users. You want to guess how small, what that small number was?
Oh, I love when Facebook says that there's a small number. What is this? What is a small 5. Number
5.8 million.
That's so many.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very funny. Okay. It's very funny. It's all good.
I that is so, I mean, yeah, that I they're just
yep.
Robert, can I say something controversial?
Please.
I don't like this company one bit.
You don't? Well, I feel like that's going a bit far.
I'm sorry. And I'm famously, you know, I don't like making harsh judgments on others, but I'm starting to think that they might be doing some bad stuff over there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would, you know, I don't like these people. I don't like these people at all. You know what I do like, Jamie?
What do you like?
Ending podcast episodes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I actually do like that too.
Yeah, that's the thing I'm best at. Do you want to plug your pluggables?
Yeah, passion. Yeah, sure. You can I'm going to just open by plugging my Instagram account, a famously healthy platform that I'm addicted to, and I don't really have any concerns about it. I don't really think it's affecting my mental health at all. So I'm over there, and that's at Jamie Christ Superstar. I'm also on Twitter, which Robert can't stop saying is the healthiest of the platforms.
I'm not so sold on that. Of all of the people who are drunk driving through intersections filled with children, Twitter has the least amount of human blood and gore underneath the grill of the car.
So Robert's saying, for all you Backstreet Boys heads, he's saying that Twitter is the Kevin Richardson of social media. I'm there as well.
I'm saying the drunk driving Twitter car made it a full 15 feet further than the Facebook car before the sheer amount of blood being churned up into the engine flooded the engine air intakes.
But at the end of the day, we're all fucked. So I'm on Twitter as well, at Jamie Loftus Health. You can listen to my podcast.
Yeah.
You can listen to my podcast, The Bechdel Cast. You can listen to ACCast. That's about the Kathy comics. You can listen to My Year in Mensa. You can listen to Lolita Podcast. You can listen to nothing.
You know what never led to a genocide in any country, as far as I'm aware, Jamie?
Uh-huh.
The Kathy comics.
Well, see, then you haven't listened to the whole series.
Oh, really? Is it? Oh, you know what?
No, I'm kidding.
That's why the last episode is your live report from Sarajevo in 1994.
Episode 11. Yeah. Irving, really, his politics were not good.
Yeah, he was like weirdly into the Serbian nationalism.
Irving is like, for the Kathy comics, he's like, okay, I'm about to make a wild parallel, but Irving is like the barefoot Contessa's husband in that he looks so innocent, but then when you Google him, you're like, wait a second, this man is running on dark money. This guy is like, was on Wall Street in the 80s. This is a bad man. He's basically like Jeffrey, the barefoot Contessa's husband. The barefoot Contessa is run on dark money. I know people don't like to hear it. They love her, but it's just true. It's objectively true. And that's what I would like to say at the end of the episode.
I've never heard of the Barefoot Contessa, and I don't know what you're talking about.
I guess I am not even 1% surprised to know that, but that's okay.
But you know what I do know about?
What?
I know about podcasts, and this one is done.
Great ending.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are coming back to Atlanta right now. Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Listen to The Passage now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.